And this is The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Late last week, the story broke that stunned many of us here in Seattle. A Kent man alleges when he was a teen in the mid-80s, Seattle Mayor Ed Murray raped him. The man, going by the initials DH, has filed a civil lawsuit against the mayor seeking unspecified damages. Now, Mayor Murray says the allegations are not true. He says he won't leave office and he will continue to run for re-election. So what happens now? We have a guest with us to help us understand what happens next. Michael Pfau is a Seattle attorney who has prosecuted child sex abuse cases. Hi, welcome to The Record.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So now that this civil lawsuit has been filed against the mayor, what happens?
Well, when a civil lawsuit's filed, it triggers certain deadlines. For example, there'll be a trial date set probably about 18 months from now. And then also both sides start what the lawyers call the discovery process, which is a process by which each side gets to ask the other side for information and witnesses, and ultimately will lead to both the mayor being deposed and the victim being deposed.
Now, the statute of limitations has expired on DH's claims, so this is not a criminal lawsuit. And you talked about the next steps in the civil lawsuit, but what does the prosecution of this lawsuit look like?
Sure. The mayor is not facing criminal charges, but our state has a special statute of limitations that allows childhood victims of abuse to sue many years later under certain circumstances. So it allows the victim, who will be the plaintiff in this lawsuit, to move forward, ask for a jury trial, and ultimately ask for damages, money damages, on behalf of the abuse he suffered, or the alleged abuse he suffered.
And in this case, it would only be monetary damages. Yes, that's the only thing that DH could potentially get out of this lawsuit.
Monetary damages. This case will not result in the mayor being criminally prosecuted.
Well, as we've been talking about, the mayor is vigorously denying all of these allegations. He's been clear that he'll fight them. So how will the mayor's lawyers approach this, or how might they approach this?
Well, you know, it's an unusual case. Most of the high-profile sex abuse cases end up being against, or the entity that sued is the Catholic Church, the state of Washington, the institution that protected the abuser. In this case, the mayor is the alleged abuser. I imagine they'll start by denying the allegations, and they'll, I assume, attempt to attack the credibility of the victim. Likewise, the victim's lawyers are going to have a lot of questions for the mayor, I would imagine, concerning how he had contact with this 15-year-old, what were the circumstances, and who else knows about the contact he had with the 15-year-old.
Also, these allegations are from 30 years ago, so ultimately, how provable or unprovable are charges like this against the mayor?
Well, we, in the cases we file, we prove these allegations all the time. That doesn't mean they're true, but if witnesses are still alive, those witnesses will be interviewed. And in the big scheme of things, 30 years is not that long ago. I don't know that there'd be any documents relating to the interaction between the mayor and the alleged victim. But certainly, both sides are going to want to find out if there are any other witnesses, if there are any other people out there who can testify that, yes, indeed, the mayor had contact, sexual or otherwise, with this with the person who's bringing the lawsuit.
Well, the Seattle Times reported that there are two other men who accused the mayor of abuse when they were teens. They also told the Seattle Times they were willing to testify in court. It's not witness to this particular set of allegations, but they're corroborating similar things. What might that indicate?
Yeah, potentially. I think it's a big problem for the mayor. You know, if you have one person accusing someone of a crime, it becomes a he said, she said, or in this case, I think a he said, he said. When you have other people accusing the same person of a crime, it can be powerful evidence. But I think what both sides are going to do is look at the quality of that evidence. How credible are the witnesses? Mm-hmm. How similar are the facts between what these two others said happened and the person who filed the lawsuit? So I think they're really key to the case. Really key to the case.
Hmm. How often are civil cases like this one settled?
Well, in our system, you know, there are various statistics on this, but 90%+ of civil cases settle. However, a lawsuit against a mayor in office who's running for election is a very unusual set of circumstances. So I don't know. I think it'd be difficult for the mayor to settle the lawsuit because I think in regardless of what happened in our political world, there will be a lot of people, a lot of voters who are going to say, if you settled, there must be something there. Hmm. And I think that's a real issue for the mayor.
Michael Pfau, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Michael Pfau is an attorney here in Seattle. He's in the past prosecuted claims of child sexual abuse against the Catholic Church, the state of Washington, and the Boy Scouts of America. We're going to talk now about making a political point, or at least trying to make a political point on social media. Is it worth it to spend an hour on Twitter arguing with trolls? What about 2 hours? How about a full 12 hours? The election of President Donald Trump has prompted that level of dedication. It's part of a new burst of political activism in the Puget Sound region. This week and next, KUOW's politics team will bring you stories of what's driving these new activists on the left and the right. Today, we hear about tactics. Reporter Amy Radel has the story.
Embracing different methods of political activism can be tough on a relationship. Just ask Kevin Tubbs and Polly Bailey. Both are liberals who felt a huge wake-up call from the presidential election, but they've reacted in different ways. Tubbs will give a blanket and food to homeless people he meets.
I'd love to say I would have done that stuff before the election, but I'm not so sure I would have.
In contrast, Bailey's activism is mostly online. For years, she had a Twitter account she never used. When she ventured onto the site last fall during the election campaign, she was shocked at the ugliness of the debates.
And so one day I just clicked on it, you know, went and like remembered my password and went on there. And that was where I actually got scary.
Over time, she got more comfortable with Twitter. Now she'll spend 12 hours at a stretch battling bots and trolls. People laugh at the idea of bringing truth to the internet, but Bailey says she doesn't want to see misinformation go unchallenged.
Part of it is just, I know that it's not like going to change the troll's mind, but it's like if you point out how they're wrong, anybody that might be reading it, like that's the audience.
People in the Puget Sound region have been energized in the wake of the presidential election, especially on the liberal side. That's documented in a new Elway poll. It found that since the election, Democrats are twice as likely as Republicans to have donated money or attended a political event. That includes the Women's March in January and new chapters of the group Indivisible. Tubbs lives in Tacoma. Bailey's in the process of moving there from Oregon, where she was working for Nike. But her despair over the election has delayed life decisions.
Let's just say if the election had turned out differently, I would have gotten another job before moving here.
Other people say they're using every possible moment outside of work to text, call, write, or march. Joe Hochwalt lives in the Lakeland Hills neighborhood of Auburn in Pierce County. He spent 8 years in the Navy and just left the reserves in 2015.
And I've always been engaged in the Navy. You know, you kind of have to be aware of the bigger picture, geopolitical picture.
He says he was never politically active before, except maybe for a school levy. But he's worried about what he sees as a lack of facts informing public policy right now. Hochwalt says he's weighed in on issues in a variety of ways. An in-depth letter to Trump on national security, postcards he dashes off whenever he can.
But they're handwritten. I don't do anything pre-printed. So I'm hopeful that someone in an office that's getting these is going, someone's writing these by hand, and they're taking the time to do that. They must be agitated about something.
Hochwalt contacted his member of Congress, Republican Dave Reichert, and asked him not to vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Reichert was undecided on the final version, which failed to pass Congress last month.
I felt that the broader response probably did have an impact.
Reichert said in interviews that his office was overwhelmed with phone calls on the issue. It's clear from Republican gatherings in his district that Reichert was hearing a lot from both sides. Colleen Wise heads the East Pierce Republican Women's Club, which gathered in Puyallup last week.
Team, we need to let our congressmen and senators in D.C. know how we feel about this health care debacle and what happened with that.
One new member of the group is Sherry Justice. She says she wants a full repeal of Obamacare in hopes of bringing down her insurance costs. Justice says her opposition to abortion and concern for the future of her grandchildren motivated her to jump into politics recently. She's become a precinct committee officer. But Justice says things are a little more complicated for Republican activists.
I feel energized because more people, because of who Donald Trump is, and he's kind of leading the way of your voice can be heard, and he is listening. I don't always agree with what he's doing.
Justice might find herself reflected in that latest Elway poll. It suggested that more voters across Washington disapprove of Trump's leadership style than of the changes he's bringing to the country. Many of these people were part of the torrent of phone calls to members of Congress since January. Is that an effective step for people to take? The Congressional Management Foundation surveys congressional staffers to find out. Staffers say phone calls are significant, but personal letters, emails, and local letters to the editor are seen as more influential. Foundation President Brad Fitch hears people say it makes them feel better to call.
If your goal is to feel better, great, you know, but you could also go get a massage and, you know, do something else. If your goal is to influence a lawmaker and engage in best practices in citizen advocacy, it's better to take the time to study the issue, to understand the impact it's going to have on the district or state, on the lawmaker, and go meet with them.
His guidance, call or write to your representatives. Request a meeting with them or their staff when they're home on recess. As for social media, Fitch says commenting on and reacting to a legislator's actions on Twitter or Facebook as a constituent is also highly effective. Between them, Pauli Bailey and Kevin Tubbs have all the activist bases covered. Tubbs prefers to call his members of Congress pretty much every day.
I don't know if it does any good, you know, but I'm driving to work, listening to the radio anyways. It can't be a waste of time, I figure.
But he's concerned that activist energy is already ebbing. He says the wait time to reach Senator Patty Murray's office, for example, has gotten shorter lately.
Either they've hired more people or more people or less people are calling, because I call at the same time every day. I have a long commute every day. And now I get through pretty quickly.
And they feel that fatigue themselves. Sometimes Bailey says it's hard but necessary to break away from it all.
He sometimes just really gets like, oh, let's not talk about Russia today.
But Tubbs says he has no desire to revert to his pre-election self. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
You'll hear more examples of new activism this week and next as KUOW's politics team reports on President Trump's impact on the Puget Sound region. Thanks for joining us on The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel. What would your life be like if, for years, your employer had you use drugs to help you do your job? Former Seattle Seahawk Jerry Wunsch alleges that's what happened to him. The Seattle Times is reporting the Seahawks had players use a combination of opioids and other drugs to deal with pain on and off the field. Jerry Wunsch now deals with joint pain, stomach problems, and memory loss. He recently won a workers' compensation claim against the Seahawks, and now he's part of a class action lawsuit against the NFL. Jeff Baker is the sports enterprise and investigative reporter for the Seattle Times, and Baker told me about Jerry Wunsch, who was an offensive tackle in the NFL for 8 years.
For those not familiar with it, the offensive tackle is on the offensive line, so they tend to be the biggest players on the field, and they have to be because they play right on the outside of the line, and their job is to stop the fast rushing ends that try to get in and destroy the quarterback. So if you you have to have good offensive tackles on a team, or else your quarterback's gonna get hurt really badly. So he did that. He did that for 8 seasons, and over those 8 seasons, he accumulated a lot of wear and tear on his body, a lot of pounding in his head. He estimates he had about 3 serious concussions and maybe 20 minor concussions. He's had injuries to his ankles, elbows, feet, neck, back.
Well, you reported on the use of painkillers, opioids, other drugs to deal with all of those injuries. So what did that drug use look like for Wunsch and the other players on the Seahawks at the time?
Well, that's a big part of what Wunsch is alleging. He's saying that he took so many painkilling meds during his years with the Seahawks in this case, and with the Buccaneers before him, that a lot of the pounding he was absorbing on the field, he wasn't even aware of it because his body was so numbed to what was going on. And what we found during our investigation is, and this has been alleged now in a federal class action lawsuit as well, is that players around the league were getting shots of a drug called Toradol, which is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. It's usually used for patients after they have surgery. That's what it was designed for. But it turns out football players for years have been taking this an injection pregame of this drug, not only to deal with existing pain, but to deal with pain they think is about to come in the game. And so you take a shot of Toradol, you go out on the field, your body is impervious to pain, you get bashed around all that much, so you aggravate additional injuries, you accumulate new injuries, and you don't feel it when it's happening. So a normal human being like you or I, we walk out there, we get hurt, we're going to feel it right away. We're going to say, hey, body tells you stop. But if the body's not telling you stop, it absorbs more blows. And that's at the crux of what he's upset about.
What are the other issues that arise when you combine all of these different drugs? An anti-inflammatory drug like Toradol, opioids, over-the-counter stuff like Aleve or ibuprofen, what happens then?
Well, and this was referenced in our story, one of the big issues Wunsch has had is serious stomach problems over the years, going back now over a decade. And one of the complications of taking Toradol in combination with other NSAID drugs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and we've mentioned a few, Aleve would be one, Motrin's another, and in his case, Indocin, which he was being prescribed regularly by the Seahawks. When you combine the two of them together, that can cause serious problems because Toradol is a very powerful version of ibuprofen. In fact, federal warning labels say not to take it more than 5 consecutive days because it can cause serious stomach ruptures. And so it's when you combine that with other NSAID drugs, it supposedly causes serious stomach issues, can cause kidney problems, all types of other issues. So they tell you not to do it. But, you know, whether it was a mixing of NSAID drugs or just frequently taking it 5 days a week, getting a Toradol shot, taking another drug 5 days a week, then another Toradol shot, I mean, that can also cause complications.
I'm talking with Jeff Baker. He's a sports and investigative reporter with the Seattle Times, and his piece looks at a former Seattle Seahawk, Jerry Wunsch, and the drugs that he was given while he played as an offensive lineman for the team. And he sued the Seattle Seahawks over the damage that those drugs caused, as well as all of the injuries that he sustained. He's also part of a class action lawsuit now against the entire NFL. You mentioned that there is some evidence that players are at least still getting Toradol injections, that's currently happening. Overall, what do we know about drug use for NFL players?
Well, we do know that they keep saying that they're getting painkillers. In fact, there's a big movement in the NFL to from former players and from even the Players Association is now looking into it, potentially using marijuana as a substitute for opioid pain medication and for some of this other damaging pain medication that the players say that they're getting. I mean, they're saying marijuana can really heal their pain. At times, it's actually legal in a number of states where players play, including this one. And so there is a push for the NFL to allow medicinal marijuana use to kind of prevent some of that. So that tells you it's still a problem, that pain medication use is still a problem if they are talking about this. I should clarify that he is not suing the Seahawks here in Washington. He's actually filed a workers' compensation claim. So I guess technically he's kind of filing a litigation against them here, but it's a workers' compensation claim in Washington. And then federally, he is a named plaintiff in that class action suit against the Seahawks and 31 other NFL teams. So and so that is ongoing. Every indication we have, though, from players is that whether it's Toradol, whether it's Vicodin, whether it's you know, name what a Percocet, whatever other drug painkiller you want to talk about, that painkilling use is still prevalent in the National Football League.
Well, what is the NFL's reaction to this class action lawsuit?
Well, the NFL says that players are receiving appropriate medical care. They say that the doctors are very careful in who they prescribe stuff to, that players are warned in advance what their medication is about, what the possible side effects are, the possible complications are. And they say that that nobody's basically carrying a pharmacy around with them from game to game. The teams aren't stockpiling opioids in their clubhouses and locker rooms. And here in Washington, Wunsch lost his initial compensation round, but then last month he won his appeal. And so the Seahawks now have until April 19th to file an appeal of that decision. And all indications are that they're probably going to.
Well, you spent time with Jerry Wunsch. What is his life like now?
It sounds terrible. I wouldn't change places with him. You know, either he's a very good actor or his life sounds pretty miserable. I mean, I witnessed him. He has trouble getting up and moving around. And like I said, he's either acting and faking it or that's the real thing. I don't have any reason to doubt him. He's a big guy. He's 6'6". He's almost 400 pounds. So, I mean, that's probably not helping. But it's hard to exercise when you're in constant pain and lose weight that way. He doesn't have a steady job. He lives in a 1,000-square-foot house that he bought for, I think it was $78,000 back in 2004. He drives a Ford F-150 pickup truck from 2006. So he's not a guy living in the lap of luxury. I mean, he has trouble moving around. He says he forgets things because of the memory lapses. And he's gotten compensation before from Social Security and from the NFL retirement fund. He's been deemed eligible for that. And so it's here in Washington where he's still battling the Seahawks over his right to compensation here.
Well, I feel like I need to point out at the end of your story, Jerry Wunsch says, even with everything he's been through, fighting with the Seahawks, being part of this class action lawsuit against the NFL, football must go on. He says that. His two sons are in high school and they play football. What do you think that says about our relationship with football? As a fan, this is a difficult thing to square.
I'll tell you what, I grew up in Canada and I played football there up until collegiate level. And I was even in training camp at the collegiate level. I've had 6 knee operations. I've had, I have arthritic shoulder and arthritic knee. And I've been knocked out once and probably had a couple more concussions that weren't diagnosed. Now, from what I've read, I can tell you I have had that. I think it's a little unhealthy in this country, to be honest with you. I think the obsession that the average fan has with football is a little unhealthy. That said, I love the game of football. I think Jerry Wunsch loves the game of football. He obviously played it for a living. I think his kids love the game of football, and he doesn't want to stand in the way of his kids playing the game. But what he says, and it makes sense, is that if you have doctors that are working for the team and the team owners that profit from keeping players on the field, it almost runs counterintuitive to providing the best possible care to those players. There's a bit of a conflict there. Look, I've spoken to some of the Seahawks doctors, and they say we would never compromise our Hippocratic Oath. We would always do what's right for the patient. But there is a conflict there because you're being paid by the team, and the team profits in keeping players on the field no matter what. They don't profit when they have to get 5 replacements for one guy that keeps getting hurt. But there has to be advocates there that are directly involved with the player's well-being for it to work. And Wunsch says if they can't do that, then football can't go on because you're going to have guys going out there and getting seriously hurt long term.
So what should fans do? You said you feel like the relationship is a little unhealthy between fans and their love of football in this country. So
yeah.
How should a fan watch football?
I do. And I'll tell you what, nobody loved football more than I did playing it. I played it till I was, I think I was 20, 21 when I stopped. But I lived in another country where it wasn't the round-the-clock obsession that it is over here, and we had perspective. I think we had a little better perspective on it there. I know I'm going to get in trouble for saying this stuff, but you asked me what I think, and that's truly what I think. I think that there are fans that are just too focused on it and that don't think about the athletes as well. It's almost like an old-time gladiators stuff from the Roman days. I mean, they want their people out there. They want them big and strong. I think a lot of the fans that watch the game nowadays don't appreciate that there's human beings playing it, and that you want them big and strong and fast and entertaining you for the entertainment value, but not if it ruins their life afterwards. I don't think anybody truly wants that, and that's what I mean. I don't think fans are wrong for how they love football, but I think they have to take a step back from it and put it all in perspective. I think this is just one more conversation that's being held in the larger scheme of things.
Jeff Baker is the Sports Enterprise and investigative reporter for the Seattle Times, and we're tweeting out a link to his story on Jerry Wunsch now. That's at KUOW. I want you to brace yourselves, listeners, because we're going to talk about emotion right now. Specifically, we're going to talk about emotion at work. What happens when you get upset at work? What happens when maybe you even cry at work? And if you're hearing me say that, you might be cringing. And there's actually research to back you up on that reaction. There's a lot of research that shows that if you show negative emotion in front of your coworkers, you could be judged harshly. You may well be judged harshly in the workplace. And that can have real career repercussions. Have you ever gotten upset at work? Has that ever happened to you?
Oh, God, yes. I have probably hidden in every possible crevice of my former offices, trying to either hold back tears or hide the fact that they were coming down my face. So that included, you know, bathroom stalls, outside stairwell, kind of dingy stairwell, inside cubicle, but sort of hiding my face with telephone. I've gone on walks. I've stopped into, you know, Duane Reade, our local pharmacy. Found myself crying in various aisles looking at magazines. And, you know, about every other place that there possibly is to cry, except in public.
I'm talking right now to Jessica Bennett. She's the author of the book Feminist Fight Club. She lives in New York. And why did you feel like you had to run away from your workplace when you were crying? Why did you feel like you had to hide that?
I guess in part because I've heard so much. There's so much conversation and I think media coverage and even research that shows that if you are a woman and you cry at work and your coworkers or colleagues or bosses see this, it's not likely to go well for you. Either you're going to be perceived as weak and emotional and perhaps too emotional to, you know, do the business part of the job. And I didn't want to be perceived as too emotional.
Hmm. Well, we have another guest with us. We have Lizzie Bailey Wolf. She's a doctoral candidate at Harvard Business School. And Lizzie, you recently did research looking into how coworkers view someone who's gotten upset at work. And you just heard what Jess had to say. Do those concerns seem realistic? Do those hold up given what you've been looking at?
They definitely do. So across many studies from both me, from many other scholars, have shown that people tend to see people who cry negatively. The one thing I would disagree with is actually men who cry are perceived worse than women who cry. Men who get choked up or show anger are perceived more positively than women who do. So there's definitely some ways that men get more of a break than women on the seeming emotional side. But when it comes to crying, men actually cannot cry, even more than women. But yes, people tend to look very negatively at people who show especially sadness or these low status emotions like sadness or anxiety.
One of the things that you started your most current research with was looking at recommended strategies for handling emotion when you feel them coming up at work. You said that there were sort of two predominant suggestions for how someone might be able to deal with their emotions at work. What were those strategies that you uncovered when you were starting your research?
Hide the emotion, so what they refer to as suppression, where you know you're experiencing the emotion, you know that it's happening, and you just tell yourself, don't show it, don't show it, don't show it. And the other strategy is cognitive reappraisal. So the idea here is that you change how you view the situation in such a way that you are able to perceive the situation as not causing the emotion that you were going to experience. So, for example, if you are feeling upset and on the verge of crying in a performance review, you say to yourself, oh, this is a great opportunity for growth, instead of, oh, I'm being reamed out and doing so badly. And perceiving the situation more positively can then lead you to feel hopeful about your future prospects as opposed to upset and anxious about not having done well in the past. So these are both very much about preventative strategies, in my mind, how to avoid showing the emotion, but neither of these strategies really were looking at what you could do if you already are showing the emotion, because as we have been talking about, I mean, people for both personal and professional reasons may end up showing distress in the workplace, and then they're already showing it by the time they're able to be thinking about the repercussions of having shown it.
Lizzie, I wanted to jump in and ask, Are men more likely to express emotion in different ways, say anger versus women as, you know, sadness or being upset?
Yes. So Larissa Tiedens has some work, I think she's at Stanford now, looking at how high status people tend to show anger and lower status people tend to show sadness. And men have chronically higher status and more power in society than women, and it is reflected also in how men and women tend to show emotion, but it's really about the status, not about biology or something. Men tend to, in similar situations, men tend to show anger where women tend to show sadness. Not always, but if you're going to err on one side or the other, it tends to be women err on sadness and men err on anger, especially when women have more power.
Does that benefit men, would you say?
Well, yes, because Larissa Tiedens has also shown that when people show anger, more status and power is attributed to them than if they show sadness. It's sort of it's a cyclical relationship where high-status people tend to show more anger and less sadness, and people who show more anger and less sadness tend to be thought of as higher status.
Wait, are we talking about the emotional equivalent of dressing for the job you want here?
I don't think I would recommend that people show anger, especially if they are in a lower status position. So I think in some ways you get status points for showing anger, but I do think that there's backlash if you show anger when you're not seen as someone who should be. Like, if you imagine a job candidate showing anger, you'd be kind of like, well, I'm not hiring that guy. And then aggression is not good. So anger can be good, but aggression is bad. So it's fine line. And there's some research actually that talks about how much anger is okay. It's called the dual threshold model. And the idea is essentially that some anger is good, but too much anger is really, really bad. So it's a fine line. You want to cross that first threshold of seeming high status, but you don't want to cross the second threshold of seeming aggressive. And if you seem aggressive, it's hard to recover from that. So I wouldn't go around giving that advice.
I'm talking with Jessica Bennett. She's the author of the book Feminist Fight Club. And I'm talking with Lizzie Bailey Wolf, who is a doctoral candidate at Harvard Business School. We're talking about research that Lizzie released recently looking at how coworkers perceive you when you have an emotional outburst at work. Lizzie, you mentioned that the research you looked at indicated some strategies for suppressing emotion, for basically stopping the emotion before it came out. You wanted to try and figure out how to deal with it once it happened, because it does happen. We have emotions.
That's exactly right.
So what did you discover?
So we looked at how people could attribute their emotional outbursts to passion versus emotion versus nothing. So we had, for example, in one of our experiments, we had somebody who was crying based on a very negative team environment, and the person either said, I'm sorry, I'm crying, it's just, I'm so passionate about this, I'm sorry, I'm crying, I'm just so emotional about this, or they just didn't say anything, and the story just ended with them crying. And we found that compared to not saying anything or saying they were crying because they were emotional, the person who said they were crying because they were so passionate about this was perceived as more competent and higher status. So then in subsequent studies, we also looked at how that can change the decisions that people make about the person who shows emotion. So for example, we had a job candidate who was interviewing describe a time when they got choked up in the workplace. And they either said it was because they were so passionate about what they were working on or because they were so emotional about what they were working on. And we found that people were significantly more likely to hire the job candidate who attributed having gotten choked up about something to being so passionate about their work as opposed to being emotional about their work. And we also found that people were more likely to select a partner to work with in the future if that partner labeled their own emotion as passion as opposed to emotion.
Why is passion a better spin than emotion? Why is that perceived as better, I guess? We're not saying it's actually better, but why is it perceived as better?
I think it's because, at least right now in the current climate, passion is a buzzword in a lot of organizational contexts. And I think that the reason, and so it's seen as socially acceptable. And I think that's actually for good reason, because if you think about what is the opposite of a passionate person, it's really an apathetic person. And I don't think that is what most employers want. They want people who are committed to the work, who are invested in work, who are dedicated to working, maybe even working more than the hours on their paycheck, you know, they're being paid for. So employers really want people who care. And so passion is seen as a good quality that we want in workers. And you can see that, for example, several of the biggest consulting or accounting firms specifically list passion in their mission statements or in qualities that they look for in their job candidates. So, for example, McKinsey & Company, Bain, or Boston Consulting Group, these big players in the consulting field, all list in their mission statements or in their hiring statements that passion is something they're looking for.
You know, part of me wonders if more people just gave in to their emotions when they felt them and cried, because it seems, Jeannie and I were talking about this earlier, it doesn't seem like anyone's actually ashamed of the emotion itself. I wasn't ashamed of crying. I just would have been ashamed had someone seen me crying. So If more people were authentic to how they were feeling, then would this behavior just become normalized? Like, sometimes we're going to get upset, sometimes we're going to cry. That's the reality. Like, get over it.
I think so. And that's actually something I am invested in seeing happen, because I think it is not serving organizations well for their employees to be inauthentic and for emotions to be present but not discussable, because I think that emotions have a very strong influence on how people interact with each other at work. And that strong messages are sent and received via emotions and emotional expressions. And yet, because emotion is seen as inappropriate in the workplace, people don't talk about it and they hide it. And they may be extra unpleasant to deal with that day, but they, you know, you don't actually see them going and crying in the bathroom. What you just see is them being unpleasant to you. And then you take that as, oh, I guess they don't think my work is very good. Oh, I'm not doing well here. And really, their boyfriend just split up with them, you know? And so I do think that having people be more open about their emotions in the workplace would be beneficial, because emotions are such strong means of communication in organizations.
Lizzie, I'm curious, though, and I'm coming at this from a couple of different places. One is just thinking practically that this idea that we could all sort of speak openly about emotion at work feels a little bit like a utopia that we'll never see.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I don't necessarily want to be in a workplace where people are constantly having outbursts. Yeah, I have this image of my daughter's preschool, and it takes them forever to finish an art project because people keep just losing it. They're four, but they keep losing it. And I imagine that, but with adults. So what's the benefit of making emotion and emotional outbursts, I guess, more acceptable and easy to discuss in the workplace? What's the benefit there?
Well, I guess for me, and I agree with you, and I've thought a lot about this, that I also don't believe that everyone should just be completely uninhibited in how they show their emotions at work. We do want people to be, you know, focused, and we don't want one person's distress to cause distress to everyone around them. So I do feel torn about this, and I wouldn't just go around saying, hey, organizations, like, you've got to make sure everyone can cry at your workplace and that'll make you more productive. I wouldn't say that. Another factor that's important is that emotion is usually a signal of something. And so suppressing all emotion in the workplace can be really problematic, because if it is related to the work, if it's unrelated to the work, then it's unrelated to the work, and then that's a different issue. But if the emotion is related to the work, usually that's a sign that there's something that needs to be addressed or there's some issue. Like, if I'm as upset as to cry about something related to the work, then that's usually a sign there's a problem. Or if I'm angry enough at somebody else to express that anger in a way that's obvious, that's usually a sign that there's a problem. I feel that I wasn't treated fairly. I feel that somebody else is to blame in my environment for something not going the way it should have been going. And me just suppressing and hiding that emotion and never confronting them about it or never talking about it you know, maybe there's instances where that could be okay, but there's going to be more times than not where it needs to be addressed. There's a reason I'm angry. There's a reason I'm crying. There's a reason I'm devastated. And just hiding it is not productive for effective communication and effective teamwork. And so, yes, getting negative feedback is never fun, but it's not as devastating as it would be in a work environment where you think, oh my gosh, now I'm totally, you know, I'm going to lose my job and everything's going, you know, down the drain for me right now. So, you know, and of course, those are the best organizational cultures. Not every organizational culture can be like that, but I do think it's a sign of a problem if somebody is really, you know, crying and devastated in these situations.
That was Lizzie Bailey, who's been researching how our coworkers perceive us when we cry or get openly upset at work. I also talked with Jessica Bennett, the author of the book Feminist Fight Club. And Jessica said while researching her book, she read every study and article about crying at work she could get her hands on. And she said some of that research showed up as advice pieces in women's magazines.
And they are things like swallowing hard, which I just did, I'm not crying right now, but I did just swallow hard. Swallowing hard and sort of swallowing the tears. There's one bit of research that shows that push-ups can actually help, because I think the idea is that perhaps it raises your endorphins and that is going to maybe make you happier. I read advice about, you know, putting on sunglasses or actually saying that you have allergies. You know, if you live in a place like Los Angeles, it's probably easier to wear shades all the time, even indoors. Probably more difficult if you're in Seattle and it's been raining for 279 days or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends who is a chef and worked in a very male-dominated place where she was cooking would always say that she and a couple of the other women cooks in the kitchen would quote unquote, blink one out. So they would run outside, they would blink one out, they would blink out the tears as fast as they could, and they would come in, put back on their apron, and get to work.
Blink out the tears as fast as you can, and then maybe do some push-ups. I'm Jeannie Yandel. More of the record still to come on KUOW. This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel, in for Bill Radke. If you're a citizen of another country, there is a somewhat smooth path to get a visa to live and work in the United States. You need $1 million to be eligible to invest in pre-approved U.S. development projects, or just $500,000 if you can invest in a place with high unemployment. It's called the EB-5 program. But there's not a lot of oversight for the projects that get money through the EB-5 program. The Puget Sound Business Journal has been reporting on some of the issues we've seen regionally from the EB-5. Emily Parkhurst is the editor-in-chief at the Puget Sound Business Journal. Hi, Emily. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeannie. Thanks for having me.
So what kinds of projects are we talking about here?
You know, they pretty much run the gamut. You know, if you're in downtown Seattle right now and you look up, there's a skyscraper going up. I believe it's at 4th and Columbia called The Mark. And that is an EB-5 project funded by some foreign investment money. You may have also heard of the development down in Southport in Renton. And that is also getting some EB-5 funding. So there's a lot of projects around this area. I believe there's 40 different EB-5 projects right now throughout the Puget Sound region. So it's a pretty significant source of funding for a lot of our real estate development that we're seeing here.
Well, I know that foreign investors apply for the EB-5, but who are they? Who are these foreign investors who apply for the EB-5?
You know, what we are primarily seeing, it could be anybody, you know, as long as you're a foreign citizen looking to get an EB-5 visa, which is going to give you the right to come here to the United States to live and to work, your whole family. And, you know, it also accelerates you to the front of the line for the green card applications. We're seeing a lot of Chinese investors using this, very wealthy Chinese folks, basically using this as a path to come here and live in the United States. And I think what's really interesting is that the wait time for a lot of folks looking to to get green cards here, which is the permanent residency program that the U.S. has. The wait times for those for folks from China and India can be as much as 7 or 10 years, depending on the demand. And so, you know, this gets you to the front of the line. That can be really significant and can be a difference of years.
So that's the people who are investing in EB-5 who are giving the money. But what's appealing about this for developers? Why would a developer want to get EB-5 funding?
You know, that's a great question. You know, I think it's a number of reasons. If you look at the way that the EB-5 program was initially put together, it was supposed to kind of direct a lot of foreign investment to, like you mentioned earlier, high unemployment areas. And that does happen if you look at the project in Southport. I think that's a great example. You've got this project that's a little outside of the downtown core and might have had a little bit of trouble getting traditional U.S. investors to back it. With the foreign investment, you know, you've got folks who are willing to put a little bit of, accept a little bit higher risk, because on the other side, you know, they're going to get a visa and they're going to get accelerated path to citizenship. So that is, you know, it's definitely a reason for them to invest that a U.S. investor wouldn't have. So they're willing to take on riskier projects just generally.
Well, you found a downside reporting through the Puget Sound Business Journal. So what's going on? What's the downside that you guys found?
We did. Our real estate reporter, Mark Stiles, has spent about 9 months looking into this particular developer who proposed a $200 million project at the Port of Longview, and then later another very large project at the Port of Astoria. And these two projects, he said he was going to raise some EB-5 money to support these projects. They promised to completely change things for the Port of Longview. It was this huge, cool refrigerated port project. Unfortunately, the project really never saw the light of day. It was the developer, his name is Captain Chen. He was a ship captain. He turned out to not really have a lot in line, but he was able to raise money and get some investors in on this project. The project totally petered out, but he has continued to raise money.
The projects no longer exist, but he's still raising money. How is he doing that?
You know, it's really interesting. Basically, he can, as long as these projects are certified by the government entity that oversees this, which is Citizenship and Immigration Services, not the Securities and Exchange Commission, you know, as long as his projects are still certified there, he can continue to raise money for them, and there's nothing illegal about that, even if these projects don't exist or have no chance of existing. In these cases, that's pretty much what we found. So it's sort of this interesting quandary. There's really nobody overseeing the fundraising side of this. It's really just the projects and the viability of the folks who are applying for these EB-5 visas. There's a lot of oversight of that, who they are, looking into their backgrounds, making sure that they're the kinds of people that we want to allow into the United States. But there's very little on the other side, looking to see if the folks who are raising money from these foreign investors are doing so in a legitimate way and are going to use that money on projects that are really going to happen. And we saw this with Lobsang Darji, who raised EB-5 money for a couple of projects here in Seattle, including a skyscraper in Belltown. And he is now facing up to 10 years in prison for securities fraud.
Emily Parkhurst, we only have about 30 seconds left, but moving forward, what's your biggest question about the EB-5 program?
You know, I think the interesting thing, a lot of people are watching to see what President Trump might do with this program, because anything related to immigration has the potential for some changes down the line. If I were a betting person, I would bet that the EB-5 program remains unchanged, if for no other reason than it's a real estate funding program, and I suspect Donald Trump is going to be fairly friendly to that and it is used by a lot of real estate developers to raise money from foreign investors.
Emily Parkhurst, thank you so much. Emily Parkhurst is the editor-in-chief of the Puget Sound Business Journal, and you've been listening to The Record here on KUOW. BBC News coming up next.